The beginning of Parshas Vayechi has something of a mixed atmosphere, one could say. On the one hand, it describes the life of Yaakov, but then very quickly moves to the summation of the years of Yaakov. Within the very first pasuk, commenting, as we know, on the opening words of the pasuk, "Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim," which yet sounds as the life part of the pasuk, Rashi has a well-known comment: "Lama parsha lustuma." Rashi is commenting on the fact that, as a rule, a new parsha will open with a new paragraph. As we know, there's two types of paragraphs in the Torah. When the Halacha talks about parshios in the Torah, it's not referring to the weekly parsha which we talk about, what we call the Sedra, Vayechi and Vayigash, but rather to the paragraphs. And there are two types of paragraphs, psuchos and stumos. Psuchos means that the preceding paragraph is left open till the end of the line, and the next one starts on a new line. Stumos is there is a space of a number of letters, and then the next paragraph begins at the end of that very same line. The beginning of a weekly parsha will typically have one of those two, and yet Vayechi has none of the above. And thus Rashi raises the question, Lama parshas ustuma? Why is it that there is no break? And Rashi quotes two explanations. They're actually two of the Medrash's three explanations. As we've mentioned a number of times, most of the material in Rashi is not of Rashi's own pen, but rather it is drawing from the words of Chazal. Rashi's contribution in many respects is what is it from Chazal that he chooses to bring? And that already is a great amount of methodology and discussion there. In any case, the first of Rashi's two comments, Lama Parshas Ustuma, Lefi Shekeven Shenifta Yaakov Avinu, for as soon as Yaakov had died, Nistimu Einayim V'Libam Shel Yisrael, the eyes, the hearts of Yisrael became blocked up, stopped up, Mitzaras Hashibud Shehischilu L'Shabdam, from the distress, from the difficulties of the subjugation that they had begun to subjugate them. Rashi is telling us that what we call the shibud, which would then be va'avodim v'inu osam, began with the death of Yaakov. That's 17 years after we had entered Eretz Mitzrayim. Now, it's well known that there is another Rashi later on in the Chumash, that is in Parshas Va'era, which seems to indicate otherwise. For in Parshas Va'era, it tells us the years of the families of Kehas and then Levi. And Rashi asks, and this is in Shmos Perek Vav, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Lama nimnu shnosav shel Levi? Why does the Torah tell us how old Levi was? It really gives us the whole breakdown. Yaakov and then Levi. Lodia kam yemei hashibud. In order to let you know how long the duration of the shibud, the persecution, was, for you should realize shekol zman she'echad min hashvatim kayam, because as long as one of the shvatim was yet alive, lo hayoshibud, there was no persecution. Shine Emar, he quotes the pasuk, the well-known pasuk at the beginning of Shemos, Vayamas Yosef v'chol echav, and Yosef and all his brothers died, and then v'achakach v'yakam melech hadash, v'yakam v'yamas Yosef v'chol echav, Yosef and all the brothers, and then the new king came with all of his new edicts. And the last of the brothers to die was Levi. V'Levi herich yomim al kulam. Levi lived, outlived the others, and that's why we're given the timeline to have a sense of when the shibud began. And this now becomes a question which is raised by Mefarshei Rashi. It seems to be something of a contradiction within Rashi himself. When does the shibud begin? In the beginning of Parshas Vayechi, Rashi informs us that no sooner had Yaakov died, which is just 17 years into our sojourn in Mitzrayim, the Chibud begins. And yet, the Yaakov's sons lived for many years later, and Levi, the last of them, we're told, when he died, that's when the Chibud began. And among the many answers that are provided to this question, between the two Rashis, the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh and others explain that one needs to differentiate between two terms. And Rashi was very particular in the way that he described each pasuk, the way he time-stamped things. Our pasuk talks about something called Tzaras HaShibud. Tzaras HaShibud means the distress of the persecution. Later on, Rashi talks about the Shibud. What is the difference between Tzaras HaShibud, distress of the persecution, and persecution? Presumably, it's the persecution that brings distress. But the truth of the matter is, says Maharal, that persecution does not always begin overnight and doesn't even always wait for a formal enactment. Sometimes there is a certain climate that allows for official persecution to begin. There are certain rulers and they may issue edicts. They couldn't issue those edicts if they didn't sense that the people were willing to follow up on them and there was a receptive ear on the part of the nation. And therefore, Rashi is telling us that the climate began to change as soon as Yaakov passed away. There's no new king yet, and nothing officially has happened yet, but the weather has changed. And the feelings towards the Jewish people begun to are lukewarm, not as appreciative as they used to be. And there are certain, perhaps even incidents and feelings and things that you say that you could that you hear that you would never hear before. And that happens enough so that when the new king comes, he is able to formally persecute the Jewish people, and he has already participants. Willing participants on the part of the nation. That didn't happen until the last of the brothers died, the Shibud per se. But Tzaras HaShibud had been happening for a while. That's the well-known comment of Maharal, and much food for thought. Shibud doesn't start Yesh Me'ayin, doesn't start in a vacuum. But I would like to add another comment, and it's based on two comments, actually, of the Ksav Sofer in his Perush on the Torah. And he raises a question that many before him have raised, and we alluded to it in the beginning of the shiur, and that is, the pasuk is talking about Vayechi Yaakov living in Mitzrayim, and the Rashi, quoting Chazal, is already talking about what happened when Yaakov died. Presumably, I mean, the Yaakov's actual death does not happen until the end of, at the beginning of Perek Nun, which is a good while into it. It's got to be Shishi or Shvi even of the Parsha. So why is it that the illusion, which is detected by Chazal about how things changed as after the death of Yaakov, is not placed at the death of Yaakov, but rather yet in the life of Yaakov? There should have been some type of closing up in the section which deals with Yaakov's death, not the one which deals with his life. So why is it brought forward to the beginning of the Parsha? Indeed, there are those who suggest that is why Rashi brings a second Perush as to why the beginning of the Parsha is blocked up. He wanted to reveal the Kates and he wasn't able to, and that's something that happened while he was yet alive. But as much as there's a second Perush, there's also a first Perush, and it needs to be explained. But the Ksav Sofer raises a very interesting question. There's an ongoing discussion, it exists with Rishonim probably before, as to how to understand and configure the 400 years of the Bris Ben HaBesorim. The problem simply stated is that Avram is foretold in Parshas Lech Lecha, Giger Yezarecha, etc., Avadam Inuasam, Arba Meir Shana. It's foretold for 400 years. If we make the Cheshbon, we were in Eretz Mitzrayim for 210 years. So how do we reconcile 210 with 400? They're not the same. And whereas there are those, and one could say that the approaches are divided into two groups in the sense that some see that the clock begins really when we came down to Mitzrayim, which means that somehow we can perceive 400 years worth of persecution in 210 years. That's how dedicated the Egyptians were. Or perhaps the clock started when we came down to Mitzrayim and it was stopped in the middle. And maybe the 400 years never really happened. Maybe with the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, had to intervene to take us out. We weren't able to go the distance. And each of these approaches has its implications and has its further details. Rashi, however, is well known as saying that the 400 years begin with the birth of Yitzchak. After all, the Torah never mentions Mitzrayim by name. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Ki ger yezarecha, at least the start of Geirus, that you're treated in that rather second-rate way as a second-class citizen, which was true already from the time of Yitzchak. There's trouble in with the Eretz Plishtim, and it's not as welcome as it used to be. And in fact, the Cheshbon, it works out perfectly, that from the birth of Yitzchak, if you do to the arithmetic, it's 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak until when we left Mitzrayim. So that is a different approach altogether. In the most general sense, the Bris Ben HaBesorim begins with the birth of Yitzchak. Things begin to get progressively worse and worse. But set against that is the most basic question to be raised from these 17 years of Yaakov's life. Because by all accounts, these 17 years were good years. As if to say, Yaakov is given royal treatment, everyone is very well respected, things go downhill afterwards. But it's most interesting that it seems to be almost something of a reversal of the downward trend that has been happening. With the birth of Yitzchak, he's not really, then no one's really treated very well. And now you have these 17 years where everyone's treated extremely well. And that almost seems to go against the understanding that the Bris Ben HaBesorim has begun, because these are wonderful years. These are golden years. They're not in Eretz Yisrael, but they're made to feel welcome in every way. But the truth of the matter is that from a certain point of view, this grace period, shall we say, is yet part of the Golus. Because the full distress of the Golus comes from the fact that the Jewish people were originally so welcome and originally so appreciated, and within a very short period of time, they find themselves unwelcome, unappreciated, and the victims of much vilification and suspicion. In other words, from a certain point of view, the Golus is worse if it was good for a while, because people tend to think that that's how it will stay, and they come to expect it, and the shock, in a sense, that the very same people who were so appreciative of them are now persecuting them, that actually means that these 17 years ultimately were Golus years, because they were launching a new phase of Golus, which is the disillusionment and the disappointment. And it's its own type of anguish that they're turned upon by the people that used to be their friends. And in fact, this is the understanding that when Yaakov dies, Nistimu einehem velibam, it's a very specific expression. Their eyes, their hearts were blocked up. What it means is that it represents that the shock of how could it be? If life is difficult, so life is difficult, and if it was always difficult, then you deal with it, and your eyes are wide open, and your heart's wide open, and you deal with what you have. But it's specifically the contrast of those 17 good years, and then all of a sudden things seem to go bad and no one knows why. That shock is really what is represented by the expression Nistimu einehem velibam. They couldn't come to terms with it. They couldn't handle it. And that is why the idea of Nistimu einehem velibam is mentioned specifically at the point of Yaakov's life. These 17 years, Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim shiva esrei shana, because this is what will lead to that blockage, the good years. And that's why the Parsha Stuma at the very beginning, as it yet talks about Yaakov's life. So I think that's certainly a very interesting approach, and that question, which is an important question, as within the bigger discussion of how the Bris Ben HaBesorim went, if it starts from Yitzchak, what do you make of this oasis, seemingly, of these golden 17 years? Perhaps they perhaps they weren't as golden as they seemed at the time, and they led to all sorts of worsening of things later on. Well, those are a few thoughts with regards to the beginning of Vayechi. As long as the Jewish people are in Golus, we need to learn these parshas and these aspects of the parshas. But of course, from Golus we turn towards Geula, in the sense that, according to the Gemara, Yaakov already has his sights on the Geula. And this relates to the beginning of Perek Memtes, which is the Perek of Birchas Yaakov. And let's see the Psukim, and we'll see what the Gemara says. Perek Memtes, Pasuk Aleph. Vayikra Yaakov Abanav. Yaakov calls his sons, and this is black and white in the Pasuk, and says, Vayome heasvu vagida lachem. Gather round, and I'll tell you, Esa sheyikra eschem b'achris hayamim. That which will happen at the end of days. And if we take the psukim, kipshutam, so that's exactly what Yaakov is seeking to or intending to talk about. Keitz hayamim. The problem is, he doesn't end up doing that. And that's also in the pasuk, because the very next pasuk talks about other things. The brachos. He gathers them together again in pasuk base. He kovtu to b'shimu b'nei Yaakov. B'shimu Yisrael avichem. Gather together. The very fact that he gathers them together in pasuk base, even though he has already gathered them together in pasuk aleph, gives us to understand that the original gathering never happened, as if to say the goal of the original gathering never materialized. Pasuk Aleph is get together, let's talk about Achris Hayamim. It never happened. And therefore Yaakov says, okay, well then let's get together and do something else, which becomes the Birchas Yitzhak, the Birchas Yaakov, to the Shvatim. And the Gemara speaks quite a few lines about what it was that Yaakov wanted to say, why it was that he was not able to say it, and things that happened after that, which reverberate until our times in our daily practice, as we'll see. The Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. This is the Gemara in Maseches Psachim on Daf Nun Vav Omed Aleph. Vayikra Yaakov Abanov. He calls his sons Vayomehe Asvu Vagida Lachem, and we know the end of the pasuk Achris Hayomim. Says the Gemara. Bikesh Yaakov legalos lebanov keitz hayamin. He wanted to tell them about the end of days, about the final geula. V'nistalka mimenu shchina, but the shchina was removed from him. That information or license to talk about it was withheld from him, and Yaakov didn't know why. But that is not going to happen now. Omar said Yaakov, maybe there's something wrong with one of the people present. Who knows? Shema chas v'shalom yesh b'mitasi psul. Maybe there's someone among my children who is not on the level that makes them deserving of hearing about these things. It's happened before. Ke Avram, after all, the first two generations, it was a selective process. Ke Avram, sheyatza mimenu Yishmal. Not all of Avram's children were on level. Yishmal came out. Vavi Yitzchak, and my own father Yitzchak, says Yaakov. Sheyatza mimenu Esav. So Jewish experience, or pre-Jewish experience, so far has not had everyone stay within the fold. Now Yaakov has 12 children. Maybe one of them is perhaps also not worthy. To this, the brothers, I suppose Yaakov said this out loud, or the brothers realized that's what Yaakov was worried about, and they responded, Amr Labanov, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. They resounded with Shema Yisrael. And interestingly, in context here, Shema Yisrael literally means listen, Yisrael. And they're talking to the original Yisrael. There's an interesting ritva in the Maseches Yuma, I think it's in Daf Lamed Ches, who raises the question, you know, formally you're not meant to address your father by his first name. If his name is Yisrael, you shouldn't call him Yisrael. But in this case, as the ritva, it was an exception, because his name was actually Yaakov. Yisrael was a name given to him by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's a title. If Hashem calls you Yisrael, that's a title of honor. People can call you Yisrael. If they said Shema Yaakov, that would have been different. But Yisrael is 100% a title of honor. And they said Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Kishem she'ein b'libcha ela echad, in the same way that there's only one God in your heart, kachem b'libeinu ela echad, so too there's only one God in our heart. And in response to that, so everyone's on level, ba'osa shah, posach Yaakov avinu v'amar, Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso La'olam Vayed. The original Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso was said by Yaakov in response to his son saying Shema Yisrael. Now, what's fascinating is the follow-up here, because it left the rabbis in a bit of a quandary as to how we should conduct ourselves, how the Jewish people should say the mitzvah, recite the mitzvah of Shema. Amri Rabbanan, Heichanavid, what should we do? What should we prescribe for the Jewish people? Nimruhu, shall we say Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso in the way that Yaakov did? But lo amaru Moshe Rabbeinu. But Moshe didn't say it. Meaning, as Moshe transcribes the Torah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Shema is in the Torah, it's in Dvarim, Perek Vav, if you look there, there's no Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso. Every child remembers the time when he's so familiar with Shema, he gets a shock when he gets to Chumash Devarim, and he's ready for Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso, and there's nothing there. He's just about to take his Chumash back and ask for a refund. But it's not in the Chumash. And Moshe didn't say it. That means that it was not transcribed to him by Hashem. So it's not so simple to say it. But on the other hand, okay, so don't say it. Lo nimruhu. But Amara Yaakov, but Yaakov said it, so we're stuck. We're stuck between the practices of Yaakov and of Moshe. So what's the resolution? Says the Gemara, Hiskinu Shi'omim Oso Bechashai. The resolution was, the enactment was to say it quietly. Okay. There are other traditions as to how we get Baruch Shem and why we say it quietly, but this is what you'll find in the Gemara. Now, amazingly, the Gemara then gives a mashal, an analogy to help us understand this idea. It's a very interesting analogy. Mashal abas melech. It could be compared to a princess. She'richa tzike kedera. She catches the aroma of very enticing food, but it's not really hot cuisine. It's not really fitting for a princess to be eating that food. But she's caught the aroma. And once that happens, she has cravings. So what should she do? She's stuck. Im tomar, if she'll say, can someone give me some of that rather balabatish food? Yesh la ganai. So that's degrading. That's beneath her station to be eating food like that. But food is food. Lo tomar, but if she doesn't say anything, yesh la tsar. She has distress because she already has that craving. Hischilu avadeha lahavila bachashai. And therefore, what her servants did is that they brought her this food on the quiet without her having to say anything out loud. A very interesting moshel. And the final thing the Gemara says is that there was one place where they instituted that Baruch Shem should be said out loud every day. Amar Rabbi Avahu, Hitkinu, Shiu Omim Oso Bekol Ram. There was a time or a place, while where they instituted that it should be said out loud, mipnei taromes haminim, as a result of in response to the complaints or rather murmurings of the minim. Okay, mipnei taromes haminim. That is what the Gemara has to say on the topic. As we can appreciate, there are a number of questions that may be raised concerning this episode as recounted in the Gemara, and we'll just take a selection of them. Firstly, what exactly is Yaakov suspecting when he says that perhaps some of my sons are not on level, and the response is Shema Yisrael? That means he thought that they're not even on board with Shema Yisrael? Which means that he's reassured as soon as they say Shema. What did he suspect them of? Less than that? Secondly, and it captures the heart, this episode, but it should also needs to be understood. When Yaakov hears them say Shema Yisrael, he responds with Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso. how is that exactly a response to Shema Yisrael? We're used to it from the Siddur. But how exactly does one beget the other? Thirdly, this resolution, this way forward, whereby the Rabbanim say, we're not sure if you should say it, or if you shouldn't say it, so say it quietly. That is never the resolution if you're not sure whether you should say something. Generally speaking, if you're not sure whether you should say something, make a decision, and either yes or no. But if you say it quietly, you've said it, so you may as well say it out loud. In any other situation like that, if it's a suffix, I'm not sure what the equivalent would be. If you're not sure whether something is lashon hara or not, the answer is not to say it quietly. You make up your mind and then decide. And by the way, if you're not sure whether it's lashon hara, it is. Because if it wasn't, you'd know. You'd be sure. But and so on and so forth. You can't take these. That's not a way forward. It's not a resolution. The truth is, before we get to the question of why this is the resolution to say it quietly, why are there two practices in the first place? I mean, let's ask what is a basic question. Yaakov said it, Moshe didn't say it. Which one of them was right? As if to say, they're two of the greatest personalities that we have, and they had different practices on the very same thing. But why? Let us figure out the best way to say Shema, and why didn't both of them say it that way? If it's correct to say it, Moshe should have transcribed it in the Torah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have told Moshe to put it in the Torah. If it's not right, then why did Yaakov say it? So the divergence of practices itself needs to be fathomed. And the final two questions relate to the final two sections of that Gemara. What is the contribution of this mashal, of this princess, and if she talks, and if she doesn't talk, and it's degrading for her, but then it's distressful for her? There doesn't seem to be a natural link between, or it doesn't seem to share the contours of what we're talking about. Generally speaking, a mashal is brought in order to take an abstract idea and make it easier to understand. This mashal seems to take an abstract idea, add another abstract idea, and now we don't understand either of them. So how is it a mashal? The word mashal, as the Mefarshim explained, comes from the word moshel. Rulership or control is to give you control of an idea that otherwise might elude you. It still seems to elude us, together with the idea itself. And finally, what is the meaning of that locale or that time where there were so many minim around that they instituted to say Baruch Shem out loud? How is saying Baruch Shem out loud a response to minim? What's the dynamic there? And we have discussed this Gemara in the past. We've mentioned a number of approaches. Ein beis hamedrash belo chiddush. And the approach that I would like to present this evening is a very special way of looking at this Gemara, and it comes from the Sefer Iye Hayam. Now, Iye Hayam is not of the better known Sfarim. It's Chidushei Agodos. It was written by Rabbi Yehuda Edel of Slonim, and he is the author of two classic works, Afike Yehuda, that's the Drushes Afike Yehuda, and his Chidushei Agodos is Iye Hayam. He's a contemporary of the Vilna Gaon. When he wrote his very first Sefer, which is on Lashon HaKodesh, the Gaon got hold of it and sent a message and invited him to Vilna. He wanted to meet the person that had written that Sefer. So that's pretty good. So let's see what the Iye Hayam has to say. The truth is that it's a very delicate discussion here, because from a certain point of view, the statements of Shema Yisrael and Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, there is tension between them. They are not the same. And they practically reflect differing, if not conflicting, ideas. How so? The full meaning of what we mean when we say Hashem Echad, Hashem is one, and ironically, Hashem Echad means a number of things. But Hashem Echad means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is entirely self-contained. That is to say, he is perfection that cannot be perfected upon. That's the full impact of Hashem Echad. Having said that, we then find the expression Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso. As soon as you talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Melech, as a king, so that's a different type of situation altogether. Because a king, from a certain point of view, does need others. He needs his subjects, as the expression goes, Ein Melech Belo Am. A king without a people, I mean, what is that? In the working sense of the word, a king has a kingdom, and what that means is that he needs others, i.e. his kingdom, in order for him to fully to be a king. And what are the implications for HaKadosh Baruch Hu and us? But of course, as we know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in essence, to the extent that we can talk about and understand these things, in essence, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't need not the Jewish people and not us. There isn't anything that he's lacking that he needs, that his people can give him. Having said that, he created the world, and over the course of time within the world, he chose the Jewish people in order to bestow his goodness to them. And the way that he chose to do that is by setting himself up in a relationship with them as Melech. As if to say, and this is how the Jewish people specifically, and the entire world, the truth is, in a more general sense, that is how they attain that goodness, by being part of Hashem's kingship. And therefore, for purposes of giving, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, puts himself in a situation where he needs to receive. Now, what that means is, in order to successfully be part of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's program, you need to be sure that you never go to one of two extremes. You always need to maintain that balance in the middle. That is to say, on the one hand, you cannot say just Hashem Echad, because Hashem Echad means that he has no needs, which means he doesn't need me, which means I can do what I want because it doesn't make a difference to him. And that is an abdication on godly living on the part of people. So you can't just say Hashem Echad, because you have voided the entire enterprise, which is called life, human life. On the other hand, you can't just say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, because that seems to be portraying HaKadosh Baruch Hu in every respect as a king, including the essential needs of a king, which do not exist by him. And therefore, we find that in response to the very first statement of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, on the part of Yaakov's sons, he then responds by saying Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso Le'olam Vo'ed. I think perhaps we might be inclined to read this Gemara and say they said Shema Yisrael, and Yaakov was so delighted that his children said Shema Yisrael that he responded Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, which is practically the equivalent of Baruch Hashem, that all my children are saying Shema. But he isn't saying it about his children. He is saying this as a counterpoint to their Shema. You said Shema, and that's where it begins. And of course, that's the essence. But you need to add Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso. If all you've said is Shema, reflecting Hashem's perfection, I need to then come in and say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, because he has a working relationship as a king with us, with Yaakov and his family and the Jewish people. And this brings us now to the quandary, shall we say, of the Rabbanon in terms of setting the course of Shema, the way that we do the mitzvah of Shema for future generations. As we said, Yaakov said it, and Moshe didn't say it. And we asked the basic question, but why did Yaakov say it? And if it's correct to say it, then why didn't Moshe say it? But the answer is the Iye Hayam, is that we need to appreciate each, in a sense, time that happened. Yaakov's time is not the same as Moshe's time. That means that Yaakov is yet in the time of the Avos. This is before we talk about mitzvos, and this is before we talk about yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu's working relationship with people. It's about recognizing Hashem in the world. I mean, that's what the Avos are coming to do, to bring that idea and spread it in the world. Which means that when the brothers, that now becomes the focus, which means when his sons say Shema Yisrael, which is the basis, Yaakov says out loud, Barashin Kavod Malchusa, because all of this is setting up for a working relationship with Hashem. You can't just have Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, because if you do, it could lead to paganism, which is really what filled the world at the time. Because if you say Hashem is complete and perfect, and he doesn't need me, and he has no relationship with me, so I'll find someone who does. Which said, therefore, in order to establish that the only one that you connect with for all of your needs, because that is the way that he has set life up, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's why Yaakov emphasizes out loud at that time, as part of the full understanding of what faith in Hashem is, with Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso Le'olam Vayed. Moshe, on the other hand, is almost in the opposite time. Because Moshe's job over the course of all those 40 years was to communicate mitzvos, as if to say that's Moshe's role. And the very idea of mitzvos presupposes that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is commanding you to do, and if you do it, it will be well. And in other words, it's all about the relationship, and it's all about what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from them. Set against Moshe's primary mission, which is to communicate mitzvahs, which is about a relationship, there was no need for him to say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, which is Hashem as Melech. Mitzvahs are all about Hashem as Melech, because if Hashem is not your king, there is no concept of doing a mitzvah in response to something that he asked. That's why every mitzvah begins Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam Asher Kedeshanu B'mitzvosah. On the contrary, what Moshe needed to emphasize, and each one is really stabilizing the time that they're in. If you're in mitzvos, it's clear that Hashem is your king. And that's where Moshe says, but you have to realize that is not essentially HaKadosh Baruch Hu's identity, so to speak. The essence is Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, notwithstanding all the mitzvos. And that's how Moshe preserves the balance. And therefore, the Rabbanon are asking, what should we do, set against all of this? And the way that they phrase it is, shall we say it? Moshe didn't say it. And what that means, you don't want to say it out loud because it could lead to a misunderstanding. Within the midst of your Shema, you say out loud, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, it sounds like that is as essentially true as Shema Yisrael. So you don't want to say it out loud. And that's why Moshe didn't say it. But you can't miss it out. Because if you miss it out, so then you're forfeiting all of mitzvahs. Because if it's just Hashem, okay, Hashem Echad, then he has nothing to do with me, and never the twain shall meet. And that is what is behind the institution or the enactment of saying it quietly. Because what does it mean when you say something quietly? It doesn't mean that it's not true, because if it wasn't true, you wouldn't say it at all. But anything you say quietly tends to be something that you say with discretion. And it's very interesting, Lahabda, but people continue to do this. Anything that's somewhat sensitive or delicate that needs to be understood with great sound judgment, you say it quietly. You almost draw the listener in as if to say, this is not a simple idea. Please use your sophistication. And that is exactly the way that we introduce the concept of Malchus of Hashem within Shema Yisrael. As if to say there is this idea, it's not exactly the same as Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, it's a way Hashem has chosen to relate to us. You need to know it, but you need to understand it and use your discretion. And that's why it's said in a discreet way, quietly, in that way. And that brings us to the mashal. And there's aspects of the mashal that yet need to be worked out. It's very interesting that Baruch Shem is compared to this spicy type of food. But maybe it's a spicy idea. But what we do see from the mashal is that, once again, the Bas Melech and the Jewish people are the Bas Melech, right? They're royalty. And there's something that they need to express. But if they say it out loud, it's Gnai. It's degrading, and it's degrading to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to call him a king in the full sense of the word, because that means that essentially he has the needs of a king. So if you say it out loud, it's a Gnai. But if you don't say it at all, it's tsar yesh la. It leads to distress because all of human endeavor has no connection with anything and no meaning. And that's why the way forward is to move quietly and with discretion. The only point that needs to be resolved, aside from the question which many people may be wondering, on Yom Kippur, we say it out loud. That will need to be addressed in light of this. Quite so. Perhaps Yom Kippur is a time where we focus really on our mitzvahs, and therefore we give emphasis in that way. Mitzvahs we've done, haven't done, should have done, etc. and so forth, and therefore it's much more emphasized, perhaps. But in any case, and what about the that time when they would institute to say it out loud because of the minim? I mean, well, how does minim lead you to say it out loud? But the point is that what the minim represents, and there's more than one, ironically, one type of min, but the point is that the minim that the Gemara is talking about are those that sought to distance HaKadosh Baruch Hu from human endeavor. They sought to deny divine providence and divine supervision, and in such a climate, it needs to be emphasized that Hashem is Melech, and therefore they instituted to say it out loud. So this is a very interesting approach to the entire Gemara from the Iyah Hayam, raises many important questions, and addresses them with this very, very fundamental discussion. Well, the Gemara, the Medrash has a general comment to make with regards to Yaakov's brachos, and that is, again, he says in the beginning of Perek Mem Tes, "Hey Asfu Vagidalechem," gather together, says the Medrash, "Melamed Shehis Hiram Alamachlokas." This teaches us that he exhorted them to avoid machlokas. And presumably it comes from the word, these words, he osfu and he kovtsu, gather together, be together. But what is the specific connotation within the context of the brachos of Yaakov? The Netziv, in his introduction to the Hamikdavar, or more correctly, in his introduction to Chumash Bereishis, he has a general introduction to Hamikdavar, and then an introduction to each of the Chumashim. And his introduction to Chumash Bereishis, where he discusses why Bereishis is called Sefer HaYashar, he talks about Sinas Chinam. And once again, Sinas Chinam is the ultimate mystery, because it exists, and officially there's no reason why, but for something that has no reason, there's a lot of it. So how does it start? And the Netziv explains that hatred doesn't always start with pure hatred, but it can begin really on the fringes of a person's even good intentions, in the sense that there is a concept of right and wrong, and one should look down upon something that's wrong, and one should encourage something that's right. There is a division between them. And if someone does something that's wrong, well, I'm not going to feel about them in the same way as someone who does something that's right, if they should know better. The question is, how do you define right and wrong? Now, the Torah has its answers, but sometimes human nature has its own answer. Because the ego within human nature tends to say that right, the right way, is my way. And that's a natural equation. Which means now, in order for me to look at something as being wrong, it doesn't actually even need to be wrong. It just needs to be not the way I do it, different than me. As soon as it's different than me, there's already something suspect about it, even though in objective terms, it may be 100% acceptable. And then Netziv explains that this was really the problem that existed so much at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, because there were so many different sects and so many different approaches. And to be sure, some of them were completely off, but some of them were just different. But people got into a mindset that different than me equals wrong, and they began to have ill will towards people that were perfectly acceptable. And no one could explain how it started and how it downward spiraled, because if a person has a default negative association with anyone who's not like them, that's most people. It's very tricky. There's a fascinating comment of the Aruch Laner, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. In the end of Makos, the Gemara tells the well-known episode where Rabbi Akiva and his Chaveirim, they come to Harabayis, and then they see there's a fox comes out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, or foxes come in Kodesh HaKadoshim, and everyone breaks down, except for Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva has this far-reaching vision. He just takes one look at the desolation and says, Geula's on the way. Not everyone else sees it that way. Most people, when they see desolation, they say there's desolation and destruction. But they asked him, why are you laughing? He asked, why are you crying? And they each one explained their own position. He says, as soon as I see the terrible situation of the Beis HaMikdash, that's the fulfillment of the nevuah of destruction. So that's one down, one to go. All that's left now is Geula. And we're on the way. The Aruch Laner says it's very interesting that what they saw was a fox coming out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And what does that represent? It's a terrible thing to see. But what does it represent specifically? It says the Aruch Laner, a fox is very cunning. And that was the problem at the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. They are post the second Churban. And how did the Beis HaMikdash get destroyed? Because the Jewish people were outfoxed by the Yetzer Hara. Because he managed to manipulate, so to speak, that is to say, they allowed themselves to be manipulated into using even some of their holiest feelings, Kodesh HaKadoshim, but it translated into negative feelings for others, because the way that I show my regard for that which is right is the negative association I have with people that are wrong. And who's wrong? Anyone else. And then you're chapt. And that's really when it says that the fox is coming out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, it's a depiction of the problem. That's why the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, because people had foxes coming out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And they just followed. It's very interesting that the brachas of Yaakov have the following feature. As we know, all 12 of the Shvatim received different brachas, which is already important. That means that there was no one generic bracha for the Jewish people, but rather each Shevet received its bracha. Different brachas took different forms, and some of them took harsher forms than the others. The first three were quite harsh, but they're still brachas, because they're demonstrating certain qualities and that Shevet has. So that's the first thing. Every brother gets a different bracha, which means that every Shevet has a different way of making its contribution to Hashem's plan in the world. So there are 12 primary approaches, not one. But there's another point, because we see that Yaakov gathered them all together before he gave the brachas to any of them. As if to say, we might have thought perhaps it's equally appropriate, if not more so, when you give a bracha to one of their brothers, so call that brother in, and each one, let them have their private time, so to speak. Why does everyone need to be there before anyone gets their blessing? But Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, because what Yaakov Avinu is saying, is the part of what's happening here, is that not only does everyone get a different bracha, which means that he has a sense of his own individual way, but he needs to hear the brachas of every other brother. Because he needs to hear it from Yaakov himself, that he has his way, and they have their ways, and they're all okay. Everyone needs to almost answer 12 amens, one to their own bracha, and one for the other 11. And that's why the Medrash says that Yaakov exhorted them concerning machlokas, because if you get that right, and again, to emphasize, it's not about abdicating on the concept of right and wrong. If something's wrong, it's wrong. But it's about being responsible in the definition of what's right and wrong. Wrong doesn't mean not like me. And that's what Yaakov is saying. It's got to be wrong on technical grounds, not just on artistic grounds. And that's why that is why the Medrash says he exhorted them concerning machlokas. And we mentioned the Gemara before, that what Yaakov wanted to do, as the Pasuk indicates, is legavos esakets. He wants to talk about the future Geula. I'll tell you what will happen, ba'achris hayomim. Except He wasn't able to do that. Nistalka mimenu shchina, and therefore he spoke about other things. He gave them the brachos. Now, on a very superficial level, it sounds like Yaakov completely changed topic, as if to say he was planning on talking about A, but A can't be spoken about. So he moved to plan B, which is brachos. I mean, they're all here. He's not going to send them away, but he can't talk about what he wanted to talk about. So then he talks about something else. It's not the same topic, but what can you do? He had no choice but to change the topic, because the original topic was withheld from him. But the truth is, on a deeper level, Yaakov has not changed topic completely. He has just addressed what he wanted to speak about in a different way. As if to say, Yaakov wants to talk about the case, but he's not able to. And by the way, what's very interesting about the Gemara is that the Gemara says what he wanted to do and that he wasn't able to talk about the case, and why he thought he wasn't able, namely a problem with one of his children. But in fact, there was no problem with any of his children. And then we move on. And no one ever goes back to say, no, so why wasn't he able to talk about it? All we ever discuss is why he thought he couldn't, and that's not the reason. So what is the reason? But the reason is because they're about to start Golas, and it's not appropriate to talk about the future Kates in as explicit terms. The climate is not right. Not yet. When it happens, then you'll talk about it in that detailed way. So what can you do if you can't talk about when the case will happen and what it will be like when it happens, not in any detailed way? So what can you talk about? There's only one thing you can talk about which remains meaningful, and that is how to make it happen. And when it happens, then we'll talk about everything else. As if to say, what Yaakov is saying is, I wanted to tell you when the case would be or how it would be. I'm not allowed to do that. So where does that leave us? Each person should hear the other one's bracha. Be sure to be together in that way, because if you are, that will get you to the geula, and then we'll finish the conversation. It's fascinating in conclusion, just to refer to a very interesting medrash. Again, many medrashim here. You see, he says, gather together. And the medrash says, how did they come to be gathered together? And it's the machlokas, how the brothers were gathered together. One opinion says, you know how they got gathered together? Ruach HaKodesh gathered them together. Okay. And the other opinion says, a malach came and gathered them together. That's the medrash. So as machlokases go, this is somewhat esoteric. Especially as the pasuk seems to suggest that they got together because Yaakov told them to get together. I mean, when Yaakov says everyone should get together, so then you don't need any more. No one remained where they were until they're not coming until the Malach comes and gets them. So what exactly is the Medrash even looking to explain? It doesn't even seem to be in need of explanation. How do they come together? And moreover, the answers that the Gemara gives, one opinion says Ruach HaKodesh, the other opinion says a Malach. What does this opinion mean? What does that opinion mean? Says Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin, when the Medrash talks about how they got together, what it means is, what is the way through which the Jewish people, when Yaakov says get together, he means keep yourself from machlokas. You should maintain unity amongst yourselves, not just now when we're all together in this room, but for all time. And the Medrash says, well, how does that happen? Because if it doesn't happen, then the Jewish people can't be redeemed until they get themselves together. If Sinas Chidam leads to the Churban, then until further notice, until it's been rectified, Geula doesn't happen. Unity is the opposite of Sinas Chidam. But how does that happen? And the Medrash says there's two possibilities. And one of them is called Ruach HaKodesh, and the other is called a Malach. What is Ruach HaKodesh? It comes from within. And Ruach HaKodesh can mean many things. But at its most basic level, it is a spirit of holiness. It is a spirit of elevation. In other words, this is the first way the Jewish people can get themselves together. From within, to appreciate that the Jewish people need to be one. And to appreciate the qualities of each other, to appreciate the legitimacies of those other legitimate approaches. That's called Ruach HaKodesh. That's called a benevolent spirit. That's called a generous spirit, an elevated spirit. Because when a person locks themselves into their own way and it's me or it's wrong, that's a very low spirit. That's a very low-level way of looking at anything. It's not truthful. And therefore, Ruach HaKodesh is the inspiration from within for the Jewish people to embrace each other. That's one opinion. But it's easier said than done, and it doesn't always happen. And the other opinion says there is another way that the Jewish people get themselves together. It's called a malach, and a malach is an emissary. And the emissary comes from without, and it's not always pleasant. In other words, history has told us that unfortunately sometimes the Jewish people, they do not unify of their own initiative. Sometimes they get unified by a force from without, a common threat, a common enemy. That's a malach. That's not in the angelic sense, but in the sense that that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of getting the Jewish people together. And these are the two ways, and it's a timely discussion. We're on the eve of Asarah B'Teves, and all of the fasts, they're somewhat remote in terms of historically, etc. But this is a very immediate concern, because when we ask, what can we do to help the situation, the answer is very close at hand. The answer is not break the siege. But it's this question, because the ultimate aspiration for the Jewish people is that we shouldn't need a malach to get us together. We shouldn't need an enemy from without. The highest form of Jewish unity should come from within, from love from within, not fear from without. And this is certainly a worthy sentiment and food for thought to take us through the coming days. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Mitzvah Hashem, we should see the fruits of the Ruach HaKodesh, less of the Malach, and get near to the time where Yaakov Avinu can finish the conversation about the Kates at the Kates, which should come b'mehira.